Okay, so tonight we are going to do the monumental task of covering four books in this one class. And I don't know if it's possible for me to be able to do that. I understand, I acknowledge my inability sometimes to get through all of the text. But we're going to do our best tonight looking at 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and the book of Jude. More than any other time, I would recommend picking up my notes on the back table for these books, as there will be a number of things in those notes that we'll talk about tonight. Books of 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Jude. Next week we're going to be undertaking the book of Revelation, and we're just going to be doing one class on Revelation. It's a one-night engagement. That's it. No more. We're done with it at that point in time. No, the book of Revelation is a fascinating book. In fact, I could probably teach it in about 10 seconds, but we won't do that next week. We'll get a little bit deeper than 10 seconds. But tonight, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Jude. I asked Scott, because he's been teaching these books on Sunday morning when he started, and he said it was about a year ago he started the study of these books. So if you've been in the auditorium class over the past year, a lot of this is probably going to be a review to a certain extent. But if you haven't been in those classes, then I hope and pray that this will be a benefit to you, because they are an incredible series of books. 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John are obviously grouped together by authorship, but they're also grouped together by subject. There's a lot that they hold in common with each other, as they're all being written about the same time. Jude is a little bit of an anomaly, because even though it comes after 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, Jude is more connected with the book of 2 Peter. And so as you look at Jude, as short as it is, it really is an abbreviated, more direct, more commanding text than 2 Peter, even though it's on the same subject. So let's talk about 1 John, and we're going to talk about authorship here, and then this should carry over into 2 John and 3 John. And so we look at 1 John and the subject of authorship. It's interesting that the author never identifies himself. He never identifies himself in 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and if it is the John that we think it is who wrote this book, he also has a gospel that he wrote, but he never identifies himself by name in that book. How does he identify himself in the gospel? He's the disciple whom Jesus loved. Or in chapter 1, John had two disciples. John the Baptist had two disciples. One is mentioned as Andrew, and the other is unnamed. Presumably, it's this John that we have here. And so even though we don't have him writing his name, when it comes to the books of the New Testament, there is no book that has as substantial evidence for authorship, genuineness, and authenticity as 1 John. So we divide it up into two ways, as we do with many of the books. We look at internal evidence as well as external evidence. Internal evidence are the things that are inherent within the book. External are what people say about the book that are not connected directly with the writer. And so when we look at 1 John, one of the things that we want to note, first of all, is that the language and the style are very similar to that of the gospel of John. And in fact, the language and the style is very similar in 2 John and 3 John as well, even those are shorter. For example, when we look at this, both 1 John and the gospel of John start in very similar ways. In John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Okay? Now notice 1 John chapter 1 and verse 1. And what's it say? "That which was from the beginning." Okay, so you see the similarities there already. "That which was the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life." Well, that is John 1 and verse 1. And then even down into verse 14, John says that the Word became flesh and we beheld Him as having glory, that of the only begotten of the Father. And so you have these similarities. Now, how they are similar in their opening, they're also similar in their ending. Look at 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13. He says, "I write these things to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, that you may know that you have eternal life." So he says, "I write with a purpose." What's the purpose? It's so that you may know, you who believe, that you may know that you have eternal life. Okay, John 20 and verse 30 and 31. "Many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, but these are written," so what? For what purpose? "That you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life." Okay, and so we have the same subjects reiterated in 1 John chapter 5 that you have in John chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31. And then there's some other things. The fact that only Son, or depending on your translation, only begotten Son, is only found in the Gospel of John and in 1 John. It's the only places where that phrase is found. So in John chapter 3 and verse 16, "God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." English Standard Version is "only Son." Look at 1 John chapter 4 and at verse 9. 1 John 4 and verse 9. "In this, the love of God was manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world." Some translations will say "only begotten Son" into the world. And then if we wanted to add more internal evidence, so this is really what presents such a strong case here, is there are phrases that are similar. And I gave them in the notes there. The phrase, "in him was life," John chapter 1 and verse 2, 1 John 1 verse 2, found in John chapter 1 verse 4. Light is used in the book of 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5. John chapter 1 and verse 7. You can go on. Love, darkness, death, the world, truth. Truth is an important one in John chapter 1, in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 6. "If we say we have fellowship with him while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth." And then John chapter 1 and verse 14, at the end of the verse, "He's the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." You remember, in John, you have recorded Pilate asking the question, "What is truth?" John chapter 17 and verse 17, "Sanctify them by your word. Your word is truth." And so you have concepts that are in John's mind, which is, it's fascinating to me because that's how we are, how we think. That we think and we use the same kinds of terms, the same phrases. We use what is comfortable, what is known to us. And that's what you have John doing at this point in time. The external evidence for the Gospel of John. You have Polycarp, who is a disciple of John, if you would, or a student of John, a pupil of John. He quotes from most of the New Testament books. But in a letter that he wrote to the church of Philippi, in his personal letter, Philippians, he quotes 1 John chapter 4 and verse 3. And then he has a student, Irenaeus, who quotes 1 John, and he says that it was the Apostle John that wrote this book. And I have there the reference, Irenaeus in his Against Heresies, he cites 1 John, 2 John three times. So, here's the question. Who's John? Tell me about John. This guy wrote this book. He wrote probably five books in the New Testament. What are they? Gospel, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Revelation. I have a hard time saying John wrote Revelation. Just for this simple reason, Jesus wrote Revelation. John is recording it. It's what Jesus said. But John was the one that penned the book. So we'll throw him in that category. So who is John? Okay, he's the son of Zebedee. Okay, he's brother of James. They are, in fact, together as a tandem. What are they called? Sons of Thunder. We talked about this last week, how John is kind of pictured as this, because he uses the word love a lot. We picture John as kind of this sensitive, emotional, loving, swelling kind of guy that just, he just loves you and all that kind of stuff. And while that's true, John is also balanced with truth, which plays out in 2 John. And when people are doing things that are false, who is the one that's going to stand up and say, that's false, that's wrong? It's going to be John. Let's call down, fire from heaven. Let's do this. And so John is good because he has that balance. And that's something that we can learn, because if we tend too much towards truth, and understand what I'm saying when I say that, I mean, you can't have too much truth, okay? You have to have all the truth. But truth without love ends up with what? It's harsh. It is the Pharisees. Jesus says, you tithe mint, anise, and cumin, but you forget the weightier matters of the law: love, justice, mercy. And so we can tend towards that, because what's human nature? Do we like balance? No, we like to go to the extremes. We like doing the teeter-totter. Either you're down or you're up. But what John does is he balances. So you have the need for truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. John chapter 14 and verse 6. But at the same time, you have to have love. You have to have love. And if all you have is love, that's emotionalism. And you have no standard, and kind of what society is you can do whatever you want just as long as we love people, tolerate them. No, there's got to be a balance with truth. So John is the brother of James, sons of thunder. What's his occupation? Okay, he's a fisherman, but his life changes and he becomes an eyewitness. You have that in the Gospel of John, in John chapter, 1 John chapter 1, verse 1 through 4. He talks about that he was an eyewitness of these things. Now, why is that important? Jesus says, you're going to be my witnesses, Acts chapter 1 and verse 8. So John is one of those witnesses, and you see it where the women go to the apostles and they said, the body's not there. Remember, Peter runs and John runs, and they both run to the tomb to see what's going on. And they go back afterwards, and Jesus appears to them in his resurrected form. So he's an eyewitness. He's a close associate with Peter. They're arrested together. They preach together. They teach together. He's a pillar. Later in life, it seems that he goes to Ephesus and he preaches in Ephesus and he teaches in Ephesus. That's probably where he wrote 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. But he's exiled to Patmos, and it's there that he will die roughly about 100 AD. What are some characteristics of John? What you know about him? Is there anything we can make from the fact that he does not record his name? There's a great deal of humility with John. even though he is the closest of the apostles to Jesus, John is very humble about his position and his place. What are some other things that you can think of? He's a leadership. He hammers the false teachers. Second John, the end of Second John, he just hammers false teaching and just says, not so much against false teaching. He's speaking about false teaching, but he's talking about how we as Christians deal with false teachers. And there's no leeway in John. John doesn't say, well, you know, if someone's teaching false, now understand there's a difference between false teaching and teaching things by mistake. There's a difference there. False teaching, John was not going to have any part of it whatsoever. He says, you can't deal with that. It's kind of reminiscent of what Paul tells Titus about you admonish him one time, two times, and then you're done. With false teaching, there has to be this this hammer, as Kathy said. Why is that? Okay, if you allow false teaching to be presented and entertained, it is going to have a detrimental effect. James chapter 3 and verse 1, let not many of you be teachers. Why? You're going to receive the stricter punishment. Why? Because here in this room, I mean, what do we have in here? 50, 60 people. How easy would it be for the person teaching, I'm putting myself out of this equation, to teach false and mislead this group? And to do it on purpose. Yeah, it's very possible. Chris? Tolerance is really a silence. It's an agreement by silence. And Nikki? A false teaching? Okay. That is really, it's the role of leadership. That's the role of the eldership. In Titus chapter 1, elders are to be, they're not to be spiritual babes, they're to be mature. Titus chapter 1 is so that they can speak to these kinds of things. Let me go over that verse right now. Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1 and the qualifications. In verse 9, he says, he must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught so that he may be able to give instruction and sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it. For there are many insubordinate, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision party. That is one of the main works of the shepherds of a congregation. Just like it was David as a physical shepherd would drive away the lion and the bear and kill them to protect the flock. That's the role of the eldership, is to be able to protect the flock. And so I have experienced times, it might seem a little awkward, where something was communicated that was false, either in a sermon or something like that, and an elder would get up and say, this isn't correct, and admonish that person who taught it, plus encourage the congregation to know that's not accurate. There are doctrines that are out there that are false. I think sometimes we can mislead ourselves and think, well, there's not a lot of false teaching that affects the church. I would severely disagree with that. I know there's false teaching in denominations, But there's a lot of false teaching that goes on in the church as well. Sad to say. One of the subjects has been, I know over the past 20 plus years, maybe even further than that, you know, the subject of the deity of Christ. That Jesus was not God in the flesh. He was just man. He emptied himself using Philippians chapter 2. And that is a dangerous doctrine that people hold. And we need to be aware of those kinds of things. Now, it's not to the extent where we're looking everywhere for false teachers. How is it we identify what's false? We got to know the truth. And that's how we arm ourselves. So you look at 1 John as we'll move forward now in 1 John. John doesn't write and give us all of the details, if you would, about the heresy that he's confronting. What was the name of the heresy? Gnosticism. He doesn't say this is what Gnosticism believes. He doesn't deal with that at all. Rather, he writes to Christians and says, Christians, this is what is truth. And that's how he deals with what is false. Let's talk about the audience. The audience is not named. We don't know who he's writing to. It would be interesting to know. Some have concluded if he was in Ephesus and it went throughout Asia Minor, but we're not sure about that. The date of 1 John. If you have the notes there, the range I give is anywhere from AD 60 to AD 100. Yeah, I'm not going to narrow it down any more than that. And if you want to know why, come back next week when we talk about Revelation. We really don't know. There's some things in John that it could be earlier or it could be later. We don't know for sure. But here's the purpose of 1 John. The apostle seeks to build and solidify the faith of the readers. In the epistle, several times he states the purpose of writing. In fact, there are three times where he says, I am writing or we are writing. 1 John 1 verse 4, I'm writing or we are writing these things that our joy may be complete. Some translations will say, so that your joy may be complete. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 1, I'm writing these things to you so that you may not sin. 1 John 2 and verse 1, I just said that. And then I write these things to you that you may know that you have eternal life. 1 John chapter 5 and verse 13. He also states in chapter 2 and verse 26 that he's writing to these things to them about those who are trying to deceive. And so the question, and I know you're all familiar with this, is Gnosticism. There we go. Is Gnosticism. Give me a basic synopsis of Gnosticism. Okay. Salvation is by spiritual enlightenment. Okay. Not knowledge per se, because we study to show ourselves approved unto God. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 15. But this is a special enlightenment that is bestowed, and you're able to come into contact with it within you through this process. And so really what this is, I mean, Gnostics, if Gnosticism was full-blown in John's day or whether it was just starting, it has been around and it continues to be around. There are a lot of things in Gnosticism that are present today. The idea is knowledge. We talked about that. The presupposition is all matter is evil. And so if we're looking at things, when I say matter, we could say flesh. This is evil. They don't believe that God created the world. Not the God that we think of as perfect and holy and always. He didn't create it because it's evil and he can't do that. And so you had a demigod who created it. And then it's just this kind of process of restoration. And they come and they give their thoughts. They're talking about Doceticism and Cerinthus and his beliefs about Gnosticism, what he talked about. But a lot of this has to do with, okay, if all matter and all flesh is evil, then we have a problem when it comes to Jesus. Because then if Jesus came in the flesh, then what is Jesus? He's evil. And so that was one side. And so therefore they would say, no, Jesus never came in the flesh. He appeared to be in the flesh. Okay, the other side of Gnosticism was, no, Jesus did come in the flesh, but the Christ aspect, which is, to me, is fascinating, because what's the word Christ mean? Anointed. And so the Christ aspect of Jesus came on him at his baptism, and it leaves right before his death and his burial and his resurrection. Okay, so you have this dualistic nature of Jesus. One evil, one good. And the part that was here during the ministry, that was good. And that's why all of that was good. Well, so you have problem number one, how they viewed Jesus. Heresy. Problem number two was their personal morality. If all flesh is evil, then what do I need to do as a Christian? I need to restrain every desire to even physically punish and hurt myself to avoid those fleshly evil things. The other extreme was, get this is pretty fascinating. If your flesh is evil, why fight it? Go with it. That's right. Because your flesh is just going to end up in the grave. Your spirit's what's going to go on. So don't worry about what you do. And so one side of Gnosticism was don't do anything. The other side of Gnosticism is go do everything. Now, how can you have one philosophy that has two opposite extremes? It's a whole teeter-totter thing. We go from one extreme to the next. You're never wrong that way. So what John is going to do is he's going to deal with this subject by dealing with the fact that Jesus is divine and that we have a divine relationship with him. And so the outline that I give you in the notes, Jesus is divine, chapter 1, verse 1 through verse 4. We're in divine fellowship. If we walk in the light, we confess our sins, we keep his commands, we love brethren, and so on. Chapter 2, verse 29 through chapter 3, verse 24, is divine sonship. That is, we are sons. Chapter 3 of 1 John and at verse 1, he says, see what kind of love the Father has given us to that we should be called children of God. We have that relationship with him. We are to be righteous. We're to love the brethren. All of that, we are able to have that relationship with God, be divine sons, if you would, to have fellowship with him. All of that is dependent on Jesus, that Jesus was divine, okay? In chapter 4 through chapter 5, he revisits this. That's the book. Now, it's interesting. I read someone today talk about the book, and he said it's kind of like, a musical composition. In a musical composition, you have certain themes. Okay, so for me, in my head, I think Star Wars, and you have this theme, and there are themes in Star Wars music. And every time Darth Vader comes, or there's some, the dark side of the Force that comes on, it's the same kind of music. And if it's Princess Leia, she has her theme, okay? So what he says is John is like that. John has his theme, and then he has different variations that all connect to that theme, just like a musical score. And it is. He's talking about one thing, and he deals with the fellowship and the sonship and so on, and brings back. Okay, that's 1 John in a nutshell. I got to move on. Otherwise, we'll be here till midnight, and I'm not Paul. Paul's sitting over there. Okay. Any comments or thoughts? Okay, 2 John. Look at 2 John real quick. Who's the author? John. How do we know? A lot of similarities in the language of the books. You see that 2 John verse 7 is, John says, "For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist." Well, that's 1 John chapter 2 and verse 19. Almost verbatim. Language is the same. Then you have the same kind of external audience, evidence. Irenaeus, you have Clement of Alexandria, Dionysius. They all credit John as the author. Now, 2 John is different than 1 John. In 2 John, you don't have an audience named. In 1 John, you don't have an audience named. 2 John, you do. Who's the audience? Elect lady. Who's the elect lady? I know you guys discussed this. We don't know. There are people that say it was a specific woman, and then there are people who say it is the church that John is writing to. My opinion, and this is, that's all it's worth, take it or leave it, I think it's a congregation. The feminine use of the term, but more specifically, verse 13 of 2 John, "The children of your elect sister greet you." Where John's at and he's writing, he's talking about the members of the congregation. That's kind of what I think. But if you believe differently, that's fine. The date of 2 John, about the same time as 1 John. The purpose of 2 John is simply this. We'll get all the way down here. Purpose. Purpose of 2 John. So John talks about in 1 John what it means to be a disciple. The relationship we have with God, loving our brethren is an evidence of our love for God. And so you get to 2 John, and they're still false teachers. But what are the Christians doing? They're tolerating, they're loving, and they are, in some ways, greeting and welcoming these false teachers. And so John says, yeah, you've taken the love aspect to the wrong extreme. And so now you need to fix that. That's the book of 2 John. And so from verse 1 all the way down through roughly through verse 6, it's love and truth. Now, look at this. We have time. I'll read some. Verse 1, "The elder to the elect lady and her children whom I love in truth. And not only I, but also all who know the truth because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, in truth and love. I rejoice greatly to find some of your children walking in truth, just as we were commanded by the Father. And now I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing to you a new commandment, but the one we've had from the beginning, that we love one another." That's John chapter 13, verse 34 and verse 35. "And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. And this is the commandment, just as you've heard from the beginning, so that you shall walk in it." Okay, what's the commandment? Love. Truth and love, okay? Over and over and over in that section. But verse 7, "Many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is a deceiver and the antichrist. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God." That's the bottom line, isn't it? How do we know that we have God? We got to be in the truth. Be in the Word, people of truth. That doesn't mean that we don't love. It means our love is governed by truth. And so he goes on and he says, verse 10, "If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works." And so while there is love and there is truth, you cannot accept false teaching. And that's the book of 2 John. Any comments or thoughts? 3 John. Who's the author? John. Who's it written to? Gaius. Okay, so now we have an actual individual. What it seems like to me is 1 John is very general. 2 John to a congregation. 3 John to an individual, most likely in that congregation of 2 John. That's kind of how I view it. That's just an opinion. So in 3 John, he writes to Gaius. Now the question is, who is Gaius? We really don't know. There are a lot of Gaiuses in Scripture. Or Gaius. There's a Macedonian. There's a resident of Derbe. That's not Macedonia. There's a resident of Corinth. That's not Macedonia. That one in Corinth is one that Paul says, I'm glad that I baptized none of you except Gaius and Crispus. And so there are at least 3 in Scripture. We don't know who this one is. But here's the point. He writes in 3 John. So you see the connection. 1 John, truth. Jesus is the Christ. He came in the flesh. Love your brethren. You have this relationship with God. 2 John, they come along. Truth, yes, but let's love and accept and warm and welcome false teachers. And John says you can't do that. In 3 John, he now looks and he says, what do we do with faithful teachers? How do we deal with faithful teachers? And so what he says is this. He talks about the work of Gaius. Verse 1, the elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth, beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. By the way, can we be thankful and pray for and talk about people's physical health? Yeah, 2 John 3, right there, John says, I pray that you are in good health as it is with your soul. For I rejoiced greatly when brothers came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in truth. Love is a faithful thing. You do in all your efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are, who testify to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. So they had people coming in, and they're speaking the truth. They're loving them. And he says, they're strangers to you, but you will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. What's that mean? Manner worthy of God. Go back to 1 John. We love our neighbor because we love God. And God loved us a very specific way, he talks about in 1 John. Talks about in the Gospel of John. Says you love people that way, sacrificially, those that are preaching, teaching the truth. Support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth. He says you don't just kick them around, you support them, you hold them up, you encourage them, you strengthen them. Okay? But there's a problem in that congregation where Gaius is. There's another individual, Diotrephes, and what's his problem? He wants to be the head honcho. And he has, in that process, what's he done with the apostles and the people that are writing and coming in to the congregation to teach and encourage? He turns them away. And so what are you supposed to do with teachers and those that are doing the work? You support them. Diotrephes says, no, I want to be the one, and so I'm going to kick around those guys that are coming in. And then he says in verse 11, beloved, do not imitate evil, but imitate good. Who's the evil? Diotrephes. Don't do what he's doing. And then there's a third person that's mentioned in this book. His name is Demetrius. And Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone. So Demetrius is going to this place. People speak very highly of Demetrius. And so what's John say? You receive him. You welcome him. You help him. You encourage him. And you do those things for him. And then verse 13 through 15 is his greeting, or the final statement. That's 3 John. So how do we balance these three? 1 John, sum it up for me. General, Christians, you need to be faithful. You have a great relationship with God based on the fact that Jesus Christ came to this world in the flesh, died, and gave his life. Don't listen to those Gnostics. 2 John, stand up for truth. Do it with the right attitude, but stand up for truth. Don't accept false teaching. If they don't abide in the doctrine of Christ, they do not have God. Don't put up with it. 3 John. Say it again, Jared. Help faithful teachers. Help faithful teachers. Okay. Great job. Good job. We made it through 3. Shall we try? Wow, I got really behind. Okay. There we go. Jude. Who's the author? I ask those questions knowing what kind of answer I'll get. Judas. Jude is his name. Now, who is this Jude? Okay, we know he is the brother of James. Now, the question is, what James? Because you have James the Less, you have James the brother of John, you have James the brother of Jesus. Most likely it's James the brother of Jesus. Okay, the individual who we presume wrote the book of James. And it's interesting, their conversion. You go from people that did not believe in Jesus to people that do believe in Jesus. And the resurrection is that turning point. The audience is Christians. To those who are called, verse 1. The purpose of the book, we'll get through a lot of the other stuff. The purpose of the book is this. Jude had the desire to write about our common salvation. Verse 3. That's what he wanted to write about. But what happens? The problem of false teaching. And so in verse 3, he says, you know, while I was very eager to write about our common salvation, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith. Stand up for the faith against false teaching. 2 Peter, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Jude all deal with our approach to teaching. How we deal with faithful teaching, faithful teachers, and how we deal with false teachers. That's exactly what Jude is going to point out. How we deal with false teachers. Notably, how God is going to hold them accountable. And he does this in a very similar manner to the book of 2 Peter. Now, when we talk about false teachers, I have a description there from Jude, verse 4, down through verse 19. Another good description is in 2 Peter chapter 2. We're talking about people who they purposefully mislead, misguide. They are in it for themselves. They want a following. They want money. They want physical relationships with women. They do all kinds of things to meet their goal, and so they use false teaching in order to do that. And so Jude is going to condemn them and show that God is going to condemn them by looking at some Old Testament stories that he brings up in the book. Okay, next week, the book of Revelation. And I might do it in 10 seconds, and then we could talk about the past year of this class. It's been a year. We're coming down to the end. I do appreciate the patience. I know it's a lot of information, but I do appreciate the patience and you guys being here tonight for this class. Thank you.